From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The National Security Agency, the NSA, was hard to control when its vastly expanded data collection was top secret. Now that it's public, and a federal judge has dubbed it almost Orwellian, now that top technology leaders are pleading for the government to back off, now that the president's put a task force on it, will it be any easier to confidently control? This hour On Point, reining in the NSA. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Is it time to tighten the boundaries around the NSA? Who will do it? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later this hour, we will go to Brazil, which yesterday received an appeal for asylum in effect from former NSA contractor Edward Snowden. And we will hear more about the legal road ahead for NSA surveillance after a federal judge's tough ruling this week. So much attention on the NSA lately. 60 Minutes turned to it on Sunday night. That report got a lot of criticism in its wake of being aired. Note the disclaimer right here in this reporting from CBS's John Miller for the Inside the NSA report. Before the piece, well, he disclosed some information about his past work. He was associate deputy director himself of National Intelligence. Here's Miller.
The agency gave 60 Minutes unprecedented access to NSA headquarters. Full disclosure, I once worked in the office of the Director of National Intelligence, where I saw firsthand how secretly the NSA operates.
Right out of the intelligence community, looking now for a job maybe with the NYPD, he asked the top man at the NSA, Director General Keith Alexander, if he would support amnesty for Snowden in exchange for securing the information that he now apparently holds.
This is analogous to a hostage taker taking 50 people hostage, shooting 10, and then say, if you give me full amnesty, I'll let the other 40 go. What do you do?
It's a dilemma.
It is.
Do you have a pick?
I do. I think people have to be held accountable for their actions.
Hold them accountable. But that's not the only dilemma. There has been another dilemma in getting full disclosure, sufficient disclosure, out of the NSA. Back in March, months before Snowden's release of documents, James Clapper spoke before the Senate Intelligence Committee, was asked by Oregon Senator Wyden if the NSA collects any type of data large scale on Americans.
Does the NSA collect any type of data at all on millions or hundreds of millions of Americans?
No, sir.
It does not.
Not wittingly. There are cases where they could inadvertently, perhaps, collect, but not wittingly.
Well, in July, after Snowden's leak, Clapper offered a formal retraction. My response was clearly erroneous, for which I apologize. The question was not that complicated. Joining us for the big picture, we're joined by Ryan Lizza, Washington correspondent for The New Yorker. His latest big piece is headlined State of Deception. Why won't the president rein in the intelligence community? Ryan Lizza, welcome back to On Point.
Hey, thanks for having me, Tom.
Where are we in this story, this big narrative of disclosure and maybe response, Ryan?
I think, as you pointed out in the intro, the big event that's sort of changed things both politically and legally is this federal judge, Judge Richard Leon, who's an idiosyncratic guy, for the first time declaring that this program, this mass collection of all of our phone records, is likely unconstitutional. That's a major, major change, because up until this point, one of the key points that the government has been able to make is that the secret FISA court, which oversees the NSA, has repeatedly authorized this program of mass collection of phone records. And it did that using a 1979 Supreme Court decision. And Judge Leon this week said, you know what? That decision doesn't apply here. It's outdated. It had to do with rotary phones and a robbery in Baltimore. And we are in 2013, and our relationship with the data we relinquish to third parties is so personal that you just can't use those old precedents, and we need to think anew about these laws. So even if his ruling, which I think some legal scholars believe will be a tough sell in at the appeals level and maybe even at the Supreme Court, maybe even if his ruling doesn't survive, I think it's changed the political dynamic in Washington. It's allowed some of the senators and members of the House who want reform to say, we have a case here. We now have a federal judge who believes that the legal the legal authorization for this program is not nearly as solid as the Bush and Obama administration said it was.
Now, he's by no means the only one complaining. Yesterday, you had a lot of high-tech leaders, Tim Cook, CEO of Apple, Marissa Mayer, Yahoo, Eric Schmidt from Google, executive chairman there, all sitting down in the White House talking mainly, we're told. The White House added healthcare.org talk to it, but the execs came out and said they talked mainly about their unhappiness with everything they're being asked to do, have been asked to do by the NSA in terms of data collection. Does the administration take that seriously? These people are saying, look, this is hurting us and it's wrong. What's the response?
Yeah, it doesn't seem like those tech executives really wanted to talk about the healthcare website, does it?
No, the White House wanted to paint it that way, but they wanted to say, get off us.
I mean, these guys are looking at their bottom line and they're looking at their international reputation. And when they go – and already, if you're Google or Facebook, you have some serious issues with privacy advocates, right? It's not like Google and
sure.
Facebook
– they collect a lot.
They collect a lot, and it's always been one of the big concerns for users of those services. And added to that, all of these revelations about how they do or do not cooperate with the government. And – I think the real game changer for especially for Google and Yahoo was this recent report in the Washington Post that not only the authorized cooperation that these tech companies and the authorized relationships with the government that they had, in other words, if there was a subpoena for information, then Google had a whole legal process about handing over that information, and that was already making them skittish. Because most of what they hand over and their level of cooperation with the government was secret and then revealed by Snowden. But they were alarmed to learn that beyond that, the NSA is going out internationally and, according to the Washington Post, literally breaking in to their data centers, which are used to sort of transport data around the world. And so apparently, if you've listened to Google, they had no idea this was going on. And that really was a game changer for the tech companies.
Ryan Lizzie, your big story in the most recent edition of The New Yorker goes deep on how hard it has been to get a handle on the NSA for the last decade and more. Richard Leon, interesting, this is the federal judge appointed by George W. Bush one day before 9/11. After 9/11, all kinds of data collection broke out on a scale that had not been seen before. And you just give example after example of times when pretty high-placed people on the top committees on the Senate of the United States trying to understand what was going on, trying to get real responses, and having real difficulty. I mean, just give us a sense of how over time the NSA has resisted real oversight, for that matter, almost any reining in.
Yeah, I mean, think about it. This is the agency with the biggest budget in the military or in the intelligence community, and yet most people didn't know anything about it. And so they are used to operating with very, very little scrutiny. And we all know throughout our history that when government institutions operate without any scrutiny, they are not always accountable. And what happened, you know, one of the reasons I wrote the piece the way I did is because I thought to really understand this story, you had to go back to 9/11. You had to trace the history of these programs to their birth in October of 2001, when basically the White House, you know, at the time, somewhat understandably, wanted to know what else the NSA could be doing to thwart an attack inside the United States. At that time, there was understandable concern about a second wave.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the NSA is a foreign intelligence agency. It's supposed to be collecting overseas. And when it collects inside the United States, it has some very strict rules it has to operate under. And basically, the head of the NSA told the vice president that those rules were making it difficult. And so the vice president and his lawyer, this is simplifying things, but I think it's true, essentially gave them new authorities and basically said, you no longer need to run everything by the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. You can collect the content of phone calls, the content of emails, and you can now collect all of the phone records and internet metadata at the time that you want, as long as you think it's going to protect us from terrorism. That's how these programs started, and they started, it was basically four programs: the content of email and phone calls and the metadata of internet communications and phone communications.
That was the opening of the barn door. The closing
absolutely.
Of it was a lot harder. I mean, they put a legal structure around that, but by the time the Obama administration was coming in, you write, the NSA was routinely violating the court orders that authorized bulk collection.
Yeah. So that as you point out, from when these programs started to be disclosed by the New York Times and others, the Bush administration said, oh, wait a second, we better get some real legal authority for these programs. And they started to bring them under the Patriot Act and under the FISA court. And by the time Obama gets in there, all of the programs have a legal authority. And as we saw this week with the Judge Leon's opinion, not everyone agrees that the programs are still legal. But they did have a court saying they were authorized. But the period from basically 2006 to 2011, and really peaking in 2009 as Obama becomes president, the FISA court issues a series of opinions telling the NSA that its programs one, that the NSA has not been honest with the court about how the programs are being run,
yeah,
and two, that the NSA is not complying with the rules that the court has set out. And it's really important to know this because Obama, literally, one of the first decisions he has to make is whether to continue these programs despite these problems.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the world of the NSA and whether a federal judge's new ruling may change it. Ryan Lizza is with us, Washington correspondent for The New Yorker. His latest big piece is State of Deception. In August, at the height of one of the peaks of public debate over the NSA contractor Edward Snowden's leaks, President Obama spoke from the White House with reporters about striking a balance between privacy and security. Here he is.
Keep in mind that as a senator, I expressed a healthy skepticism about these programs. And as president, I've taken steps to make sure that they have strong oversight by all three branches of government and clear safeguards to prevent abuse and protect the rights of the American people. But given the history of abuse by governments, it's right to ask questions about surveillance, particularly as technology is reshaping every aspect of our lives.
If you listen closely, there was a very big gulp after there that he asserted that he's taken steps for strong oversight by all three branches of government on what the NSA is up to. And he raises the question himself about what is sufficient as technology evolves. That's the issue that the judge was pointing at this week when saying, look, when we've got this technology at the heart of our lives, how do we keep proper control on security agencies that might be right there at the heart of our lives along with it if they're tapping and tracking everything? Ryan Lizza is with us from Washington. With us from Washington as well right now is Devlin Barrett. He's Justice Department reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Devlin, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
What do you see ensuing? And the president has a lot to say about this. His Justice Department, presumably, will be in the middle of what happens after Judge Richard Leon's ruling this week. What's the path ahead? Now the judge has said this looks almost Orwellian. The founders, the drafters of the Constitution will be aghast. What now, Devlin?
Well, it's interesting because Judge Leon's decision is essentially everything Edward Snowden and his supporters could have hoped for, really, in a lower circuit ruling on this. But it's not the only thing the government has to worry about in terms of defending these programs. There's a similar case in New York brought by the ACLU. There's another case on the West Coast brought by the Electronic Frontier Foundation. And one of the effects, legally, of the Snowden revelations are in the documents that he put out, are that there are suddenly a lot more arrows in the quiver of the folks who are trying to stop these programs. So you don't just have to beat back Judge Leon's decision from a legal perspective, from the government's perspective. You have to beat back all these cases that are cropping up, some of them on the civil side, like lawsuits like this, but also in the criminal context when they have brought suspected terrorists to trial in the U.S., because it's going to be an issue there. And I think internally, the debate is how.
Do you mean in Snowden's criminal trial, if and when we see one?
No, I'm sorry. There are suspects in the United States who are charged with crimes based in part on evidence gathered by NSA bulk surveillance.
I see. Let's say terror suspects, maybe.
Terror suspects, exactly. Mm-hmm. And so those cases will also be avenues, legal avenues, to challenge these programs. And so, as important as Judge Leon's decision is, you know, the government has to look at the horizon, the legal horizon on this, and say, actually, there could be a number of these coming over the hill, and we may not have the ability to fight them all. I mean, I think legally everyone expects this to get to the Supreme Court, right? That what Judge Leon just said was, you're basing this in large part on a 1979 ruling that doesn't envision the way people communicate today, and mm-hmm. certainly never envisioned the way you could conduct surveillance over that communication. So the Supreme Court has to take a look at this. And, you know, I it's impossible to predict how the court will take that issue. But I think most people now expect it's going to get to the Supreme Court, and it's going to be a very interesting argument in which you could actually see the two poles of the court, you know, your Ginsburgs and your Scalias actually in agreement on this issue.
On which side?
On the side of that this is a violation violation of the Fourth Amendment. You know, one of the interesting political issues that this NSA spying has created is that it's the people most aggrieved by this are the far right and the far left, and it is the people who are sort of read in over long periods of time, meaning the people on the intelligence committees, the people who do national security in the executive branch. Those folks seem to be comfortable with it. For the folks who are on the inside, there does not seem to be much outrage in general. For the folks who are on the outside, that's where you see a lot of the consternation and concern.
If this moves forward, Devlin, how will it move forward? How long might it take for this to come to some head?
It'll probably take at least a year, is my guess. I mean, you could very well have a situation where you're well into 2014 before the appeals court hears Judge Leon's opinion and sort of makes its determination on what Judge Leon has said. At that point, there's going to be other cases. Like I said, the one in New York is a distinct possibility. And there's going to be all this stuff sort of bubbling up through the legal system. But that's a slow process. If you think about, for example, by comparison, the way a lot of the Gitmo detentions ended up coming to the Supreme Court, that took years to work its way through. And it's very likely that it'll take years for this issue, just the phone issue, forget the internet issues, which is a whole other set of worms, to come to some sort of resolution.
Devlin Barrett with the Wall Street Journal covering the Justice Department there. Devlin, thank you for being with us.
Sure, thank you.
Ryan, Liz, here we have Dianne Feinstein, senator out of California, saying, my hope is the Supreme Court will take this case. She says, we don't want to do what's unconstitutional. This is in the last, day or so she said this. Those of us that support the program that Judge Leon went after support it because we believe it's one tool among others that helps keep the nation safe. There's Dianne Feinstein. You write a lot about Senator Wyden out of Oregon on the same committee with a very different view of what's going on. Give us a sense of these two senators who are as close as anybody has been on the Senate Intelligence Committee to this and the two different views that they've developed and what they may be thinking now, Feinstein and Wyden, about what to do.
Yeah, two West Coast Democrats who probably agree on just about everything else but on these intelligence matters are completely at odds. Wyden, for the last decade, since he started on the Intelligence Committee in 2001, and read about the NSA's surveillance programs for the first time in the New York Times, like everyone else did in December 2005 when they first wrote about warrantless wiretapping. I think that really changed his view about how vigorous the Intelligence Committee was in its conduct of oversight. And ever since then, he's basically been trying to get to the bottom of what the heck the NSA was doing with its domestic surveillance programs. And, you know, before June of 2013, when the leaks from Edward Snowden started, Wyden had done everything short of revealing classified information to try and get attention to this issue, to try and get people to learn about the fact that the government went behind closed doors to the FISA court and essentially got the court to reinterpret a law that was on the books to do something that, if you read the plain language of the law, nobody in a million years would have thought that it was being used to collect everyone's phone records and put it in a giant database that they could search whenever they want. On the other hand, Dianne Feinstein, she thinks that this is one of the most regulated programs that the NSA does. In fact, she's actually more worried about the foreign programs, which don't have a FISA court and don't have the same level.
They can do essentially anything.
Pretty much, yeah. You know, overseas, they would object. The NSA would object to that, but they really, it's pretty sweeping their powers to collect information overseas that's on non-Americans. And so she argues that the FISA court oversees this. The Intelligence Committee is fully briefed on this. They've even they even had a briefing for non-Intelligence Committee members of Congress when they had to reauthorize the Patriot Act, that the compliance issues that were reported or that were disclosed this year were all taken care of, and that this program protects us from attacks. So absolutely at odds over this. I will say the statement you read from Senator Feinstein was very interesting because she is someone that has always defended the program as being constitutional because of that 1979 Smith versus Maryland decision. And she took a step back yesterday and I think showed a certain amount of deference to the court and I think said and actually called for the Supreme Court to review this. So I think there's a little bit of an opening with her or a little bit more open-mindedness about the legality of this program than we'd seen previously from her.
What struck me in your report was how difficult it was even for Senator Wyden on the Senate Intelligence Committee. That's about as close and high placed as you can get here, shy of the White House itself. I had so much difficulty understanding, knowing what was even going on. He says at one point in your piece, he had 15 minutes a year to ask questions. I suppose he could put others behind closed doors, but again and again, those simply weren't answered.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at this has been declassified, so you can actually see it. If you look at the correspondence back and forth between Wyden and the intelligence community, it's like what we run into as journalists, only he's actually a United States senator on this committee that is supposed to be conducting oversight. They just don't give him any information. He was on the committee from 2001 until 2007. This program, this phone records program, had been up and running for 6 years before he actually had a full understanding of what it was doing. He argues that things are a little bit better now in the second half, in the last 2 years of the Bush administration and into the Obama administration, he gets more information. But just look at that example that you cited before when Clapper, the head of the intelligence community, came before his committee, before the intelligence committee, and essentially did not tell the truth.
I.e. lied.
He lied. He lied. He lied to a direct question. He gave a false answer to a direct question. As Wyden says in the story or told me, there's no evidence that ever would have been corrected absent the Snowden disclosures. Absent the fact that we found out that he lied, there's no way he would have corrected it.
We've got all kinds of response here. Randy writes to us on Twitter, who cares what the founding fathers would say? They don't live today. The Constitution should be interpreted for today. Who cares? They don't live with these threats. But then here's Dustin writing to us on Facebook, Ryan, says, ditch all the bulk data gathering without explicit evidence for investigation, period. He goes on to say, the idea that they can play God, preventing violence with servers and algorithms, would be laughable in its arrogance were it not for its inevitable destructive effects to personal liberty. Let's hear straight from our listeners. Sarah in Glastonbury, Connecticut. Sarah, you're on the air. Thanks for calling. What do you think?
Hi, Tom. Hi. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah.
Perhaps it has to do with our close proximity to New York.
Where 9/11 happened.
Mm-hmm. Or Boston, mm-hmm. where we have children, mm-hmm. one of which was actually at the finish line.
In the marathon bombing? Oh, I'm glad they're...
And I think we really have to think long and hard about the primary thrust of the entire program, which is keeping our country safe. And what is it going to take to keep our country safe?
And
I think that there's always a trade-off. There are always compromises that have to be made in pretty much every situation these days. But the overriding justification for what we do is to make sure that we're doing the best that we can do to try to keep our people and our resources and our country safe.
Sarah, how far would you take that? Let's say, that's the question here, isn't it? We could build a wall. We could tell everybody to stay inside their homes. We could photograph you every minute of every day. I mean, how far do you go?
Well, I think one of the things that struck me, which was in watching the 60-minute piece, was that I learned for the first time what metadata even was. I learned for the first time about the potential for cyber attacks that could literally take the country down. I'm learning a lot of things that I really didn't know before. You know, it's nice when you don't know because then you're not, because you don't get that concern. But the point is that we do live in a different world. We live in an era where we have technology that can do some pretty amazing things and some pretty devastating things.
But the question still stands, though, how much freedom and privacy you're willing to give up for safety. I mean, surely there's a limit that would be too much for you. If you were told, stay in your home because we have to police the streets, don't go out today or tomorrow or all this month, wouldn't you start to say, wait a minute? I mean, where's the line?
I think what you're talking about, Tom, is a little bit different from what they're talking about right now.
There's great concern
that the government is listening to every phone conversation that we have. And with the metadata, that actually is not happening. What's happening...
Yeah, sir, we've got... Let me take that straight from the horse's mouth here, from Keith Alexander, if I may. And I appreciate your call very much, Sarah. But here's that CBS exchange. Of course, the framing of this exchange has come in for plenty of criticism itself. But let's listen. This is the CBS correspondent, John Miller, asking the head of the NSA, the director of national security, to clarify confusion among Americans, as Miller put it, about what the NSA is vacuuming up.
That sounds like spying on American.
Right, and that's wrong. That's absolutely wrong. There's no.
You don't hear the calls.
You don't hear the call.
You don't see the name.
You don't see the names.
You just see this number called that number.
The to from number, the duration of the call, and the date time group. That's all you get. And all we can do is tell the FBI that number is talking to somebody who is very bad. You ought to go look at it.
60 Minutes and General Alexander sort of very assiduously minimizing what's going on here. But this is the same thing, isn't it, Ryan, that Judge Leon said would leave the drafters of the United States Constitution aghast.
Yeah, that's the program that Leon says is likely unconstitutional. And his argument is that when you're collecting that volume of metadata, all of our phone calls, who we call, the time and duration. And by the way, one other piece of information that is collected, and there's some dispute about what is done with this, but if you look closely at the FISA pages, they're also collecting the unique identification number of your cell phone and what they call trunk lines and some of this other technical data that comes through the metadata. And there are some technical people who say that you can use that to locate a person. Now, the NSA says they're not locating a person, but it's in the database. So, I've talked with a lot of these intelligence officials, especially the lawyers that oversee the program. A lot of them are people of goodwill who want to do the right thing and are very cautious and care about civil liberties.
But you report again and again about the agency running right past the boundaries that were explicitly set.
Exactly. And even if you trust the current group of people at the NSA and the administration, do you really want to set up this program for the long term? As a country, do we really want the NSA to have this authority basically forever? It's not always the folks today you have to worry about. It's some administration in the future who's tempted to misuse this information.
Orwell said, watch out for this. But Sarah says, look, we've seen what we've seen in New York and Boston. Bring on a fair bit of this. She's ready for it, for security. These are big decisions. And then, even once they're made, how to be sure they're acted on. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour about the world of the NSA, the National Security Agency, and whether a federal judge's new ruling may change it. Ryan Lizza is with us, Washington correspondent for The New Yorker. Big piece in this last week's issue, State of Deception. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. Mark's calling from Lexington, Kentucky. Mark, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I'd like to respond to one of your earlier callers who mentioned the Boston bombing.
Mm-hmm.
These programs were in place when that attack occurred. So to make the argument that these programs are making us safer, we have conclusive evidence that they don't. So if I'm going to give up my Fourth Amendment protections in the name of phantom security, then I demand perfection, which is something they cannot offer me.
It's a very reasonable point, and I'm glad you raised it, Mark. Ryan, what about it? I mean, there were the marathon bombings. These programs were in place. The NSA says it needs big haystacks to find the needle. It had the big haystack. It didn't find the needle.
Yeah, and look, I talked to the director of the National Counterterrorism Center, a guy named Matt Olson, about this. And one of the things that he said is the information that they had about the bombers, about the brothers, you know, specifically this tip from the Russian Foreign Service, this is the head of the National Counterterrorism Center. This is the guy whose job it is to protect us from terrorist attacks. He said, based on the information they had, there is no surveillance regime that anyone in this country would ever tolerate that would have led the government to take that information from the former KGB and basically put a full-time 24/7 surveillance on these guys.
So this thing, it would have taken more than they knew?
Well, he was just saying that there was no way to prevent that attack, and there was no surveillance regime that would be consistent with our Constitution that anyone would tolerate. To think that the government, based on some minor tip about this guy traveling to Russia, would ever would have just placed him under 24/7 surveillance.
But Mark is already, our caller Mark in Lexington, Kentucky, is already saying, look, even what they're doing now, I'm uncomfortable with. It's too much, yeah. And it didn't stop it. It would have taken a lot more, I guess that suggests. He's saying it's too much now. I mean, what about the effectiveness here? Sarah calls in and says, keep us safe. Mark says, look, we're giving up all this Fourth Amendment. And the judge says, we're giving, you know, the founders would be aghast. We're giving that up. Mark says, we're not getting security in return. So what about the deal that, here, if you want to look at it that way?
That is the key question, and that's what the judges look at when they look at these programs, is if you're going to collect a massive amount of data, if you're going to infringe on Americans' liberty, then you better be able to show that the amount of security we get in return is commensurate, right? And, you know, this is Ron Wyden and Mark Udall and Jim Sensenbrenner and the other people in Congress who want to shut this program down. This is their big point. Show us what attacks you've stopped. Show us how this program is actually doing anything. And the evidence just isn't there. And so if you're going to conduct a mass surveillance program, you know, I went into this piece very open-minded about it. I thought, well, what's the big deal? It's just phone records. But what really convinced me that this isn't that this program probably needs to be shut down is the fact that there's no evidence that it's doing anything.
Well, if James Clapper were with us right now, wouldn't he say, well, you have no idea of all the flies we've swatted down, all the threats we've turned back. I mean, we live in a state of constant threat, and these programs, I mean, he does say these are necessary to keep us safe.
The bottom line is, if you can, for me, the issue is, if you can do it anyway, if you can investigate these things with traditional warrants, if you get a phone number of a bad guy and you get a cell phone, you want to know who he's been calling and who they've been calling, and why not just go to the court, get the warrant, go to the phone companies, get the information. And everything I've seen, they could do that the old-fashioned way. They don't need to be collecting the data ahead of time.
What about the need for speed argument? That's been out there a lot.
Yeah, and that's something that Judge Leon addressed in his opinion. And if you read the opinion carefully, he really wasn't very impressed by the need for speed argument. He basically said that in all the cases that they've cited where this program has been helpful, it would have been no different if they had waited a couple of days and used traditional search warrants. So the sort of legal principle here is, you know, there has to be suspicion before you go do a search. There has to be suspicion before you collect data about me. And if I don't have any tie to terrorism, why are you collecting my phone number?
What's the White House proposing here? They've got a task force. It's been looking at this. The president said, you know, before the end of the year, and then they're coming out with some proposals. What's their view?
Well, since day one, they have obviously defended the program and its legality.
Even though Senator Obama was unbelievably critical of this whole vein of security data collection.
He was critical of it. He tried to actually rewrite the section of the Patriot Act that actually justifies this program. Although he didn't know that section was being used to justify this, he had concerns about the sweeping authority under the Patriot Act, and he literally, just as the Bush administration was about to go before the FISA court and use the Patriot Act to justify this program, Obama was trying to shut that part of the Patriot Act down, or at least make it much more difficult for the government to collect these kinds of records.
So now,
of course, he's reauthorized the program many times since he's been president. The first starting right away when he became president in January 2009, and he's got this group that's looking at it. And there's been some conflicting reports about what this group is going to propose. the stuff that leaked out last week is that the president might propose, instead of the NSA collecting all of this data, some kind of third party would be responsible for it, and then the NSA would go to that third party when it wanted to search it.
A private company would keep all the data in a can and open it up for specific reasons.
Exactly. And I have to say that could open up a whole can of worms that and frankly, it could be even worse than the NSA having it. If you have some entity out there that has a database of all of our phone records, think about who else is going to want access to that. Divorce lawyers, local cops. It's going to be and maybe they could build in some safeguards, but I don't see how it matters who collects this. I think the point is that any entity, whether private or public, is putting together this massive database and searching it. That's the problem.
Privacy maybe gone with the wind. Founders could be aghast about all kinds of things here. Russ in Plattsburgh, New York. Russ, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. I want to say that I think the federal judges' characterization of this as Orwellian is right on target. This is exactly the kind of thing that for so long we fought against in the Cold War. I'm 55 years old. I spent most of my life learning how bad organizations like the KGB were, and the reason that they were bad is they did things like this, and their justification was always that the security of the state was paramount. Anything that furthered the security of the state was okay, and that's why I have the thing that scares me the most here is that is being used as the justification for these programs, and we're in sort of the parable of the boiling frog. We've become so used to the hot water that now that it's boiling, people are saying, it's okay. It's okay that it's boiling because the security is paramount. And
yeah.
If anything, it's built into us as Americans and as human beings to fight against this, and in some ways, this is going to make us less secure because nobody wants to be surveilled to this degree.
Well, I mean, one time maybe that was true, but these days you hear a lot of people saying, oh, maybe it's okay. But I take your point fully, Russ, and I am sympathetic. Jackie, thank you. Jackie in West Hartford, Connecticut. Jackie, you're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My question is from the perspective of a Gen Xer.
Yeah.
I have friends that are baby boomers and older. I have friends that are millennials and Gen Y.
Yep.
And I'm finding that this debate really depends on where you land. And as a Gen Xer, I'm kind of in the middle. Younger folks don't see it as an issue in privacy. They live online. Everything is out there for you to see. My older friends are aghast, and they feel it's a slippery slope. My question is, as our country gets older, and as these younger generations become the judges and the lawyers and the legislators, what are your thoughts of the impact on our Bill of Rights and our Constitution? Thanks.
That's an interesting question, Ryan. That's a huge question, but
that's a big question. Yeah.
What about it? What's your response?
I think I don't agree with her about the generational divide here. I think the evidence on this is mixed. I think you find a huge group of young people who, yes, are used to divulging lots of personal information about themselves on Facebook and Twitter and elsewhere. But the key thing is they control it. They control when they put a picture of themselves up or any other information about themselves. And I think for people who grow up in the current digital world, the world of sharing and the world of giving a lot of information about yourself and trusting a lot of information about yourself to third parties like Google and Facebook, I think those are the people that are the most concerned about this, because this law, this stream of law that Judge Leon is challenging this week, the back in 1979, the Supreme Court said, well, if someone has no right to privacy over the phone numbers that they dial from their home phone, right? Mm-hmm. So this precedent was set that this third party doctrine, the information we give to a third party, we have no expectation of privacy. Fast forward to 2013, think of how much information we entrust to third parties.
Oh, yeah.
And if you take that to its logical extreme, we're living in what Leon called this sort of near Orwellian state.
Time to get it all on the table and really articulate principles and threats, because this country has big decisions to make, and clearly the intelligence apparatus is very happy to make them for us if they're not laid out clearly in public. Ryan, Lizzie, you've helped us do that, and we hope you will come back and do it again. New Yorker writer, Washington correspondent Ryan Lizzie in Washington, thanks for joining us today, Ryan.
Thanks for
having
me.
Great to have you. In a moment, Edward Snowden's open letter to the people of Brazil. This is On Point. Remember Edward Snowden? He's out there. He's in Russia. He broke all this open. Let's just bring him back to mind for a moment. In the Guardian newspaper's Hong Kong interview with NSA contractor Edward Snowden, this was in June, he told journalist Glenn Greenwald he doesn't want his every communication to be recorded. Here was Snowden then.
I don't want to live in a world where everything that I say, everything I do, everyone I talk to, every expression of creativity or love or friendship is recorded. That's not something I'm willing to support. It's not something I'm willing to build. And it's not something I'm willing to live under. I think anyone who opposes that sort of world has an obligation to act in the way they can. I've watched and waited and tried to do my job in the most policy-driven way I could, which is to wait and allow other people, you know, wait and allow our leadership, our figures, to sort of correct the excesses of government when we go too far. But as I've watched, I've seen that's not occurring. And in fact, we're compounding the excesses of prior governments.
Edward Snowden, he waited and then he acted, been called a traitor and a hero and everything else in recent months. He tore back the veil on the NSA and its secret surveillance programs. Then he ran. The U.S. wants him to face the law. Serious charges. Snowden's hunkered down in Russia now. Yesterday, he made a pitch to the people of Brazil in an open letter that seems to be seeking asylum. He said he could help Brazilian investigations into American spying. Joining me now from Sao Paulo, Brazil, is Vincent Bevins, Brazil correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. He runs the From Brazil blog for Folha de Sao Paulo, the prominent Brazilian daily newspaper that published Edward Snowden's open letter to Brazil. Vincent Bevins, welcome to On Point. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Did Brazilians interpret this letter as a request for asylum?
Well, that was a bit confused as it came out. I think the idea that Snowden would like to have a Brazil grant asylum to him was not new here. It hasn't been new since July. He submitted, or at least Brazil received a request back in July and decided not to consider it. But in the five months since that happened, revelations here have come out that the U.S. has been spying not only on civilians, but the president and Brazil's state-run oil company, which has led a lot of people to believe this couldn't have much to do with terrorism. So it seems like what this letter was an appeal directly to the people to pressure the government to reconsider the position it's had since July as to not consider the asylum request.
Well, let's look at both sides of it. He says in the letter that he can help Brazil figure out exactly what kind of surveillance they've been the target of, the government people there, the oil company, which brings up competitive issues, maybe beyond terrorism issues. Is that persuasive? Does Brazil feel like it needs help? It could use Edward Snowden's help to figure out who's listening and to what?
Well, on this issue, he didn't actually start this conversation. There is a Senate Foreign Relations Committee that has been seeking to speak with him, whether in Brazil or in Russia, and they have questions for him, just like they have asked Glenn Greenwald to come in and speak before the Senate. So he is, in a sense, responding to a legitimate outreach on one part of the Brazilian government. Whether or not that goes all the way up to the top, to the people that would actually make a decision, is dubious. But he was contacted by the Brazilian government.
Does Brazil feel that it knows at this point how it's being watched by the United States, or does it feel vulnerable, I don't know, naked?
I think Brazil is extremely conscious always of how the United States may be watching what's going on here. And I think the reaction to the letter from the foreign minister yesterday was quite telling. They basically decided to ignore it. They said, we've gotten no official response, and we won't respond to anything that is not an official response. We may someday in the future consider an official request, but we don't consider this a request, and that's all they really wanted to say about it.
You mean an official request for asylum?
An official asylum request, yes.
And what about politically or in a more popular way? I don't know how you judge the response to an open letter to the people of Brazil, but what about sentiments there? Is there sympathy for Edward Snowden? You can see why he might rather live in Rio than Moscow, let's say, or Sao Paulo, but how about the Brazilian people to the extent that you're able to tap into that? What's the attitude toward him?
Well, I think that the Brazilian government and the Brazilian people are quite sympathetic to him as a whistleblower, but that doesn't exactly mean that they want to take on the fire of directly opposing the United States and granting him asylum. One reason I think that the president would be unlikely to grant asylum is that she already took on the United States quite directly in September in two different ways as a result of these revelations. First, she canceled a very important visit to Washington as a result, and then she harshly criticized the United States at the United Nations for its buying practices. Now, neither of these moves were seen as politically stupid. To the contrary, they were seen as a savvy way to speak to her base against what might have been seen as U.S. abuses of power in the region. I mean, we can remember that for historical reasons and perhaps good reasons, Brazilians in South America are suspicious of U.S. abuses of power in the region. We have to remember that the U.S. backed the military dictatorship, which spied on its people and then actually imprisoned and tortured the current president of Brazil. So I think that being seen as standing up to U.S. powers usually pays political dividends here, but I think that the government's already done that in the way that they've liked to do it, and I don't know if they'd want to take on the United States by giving him direct asylum.
Reporter Vincent Bevins with the Los Angeles Times in São Paulo. Thank you, Vincent, for joining us.
Thank you.
Sounds like Edward Snowden may be in Moscow for a while. We'll see. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.